Hi there, dolls, music lovers, and fashion enthusiasts. Welcome to Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s, the podcast that takes you on a groovy journey through the lives and legacies of the incredible women who shaped these iconic decades. We are your hosts, Emma
and Abby,
and together we'll explore the stories behind the music, the fashion, and the cultural revolution that defined an era.
But today is not that. We've just concluded our very first season of the Dolls Pod, and today is the Q&A bonus episode!
Yay!
Last week, and the week before that, we had two separate question sessions for you guys because of an overwhelming response. We have picked 25 of your burning questions to answer yes. for you today about the show, about how we run the show, and some questions about us.
Yeah.
So if there was anything you wanted to know, this is the week. So how have you been since our season finale, our first season finale? I got a little emo over it.
Me too. It felt like an ending, but it also felt like the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's so much more to come. But yet I was a little sad because now we're not gonna talk for like 2 hours every other week.
Yeah.
I mean, we'll still like talk all the time, but not like this. And I love that we just get lost in these topics together.
It feels
like such a niche thing to do, and it's so special to find someone you could do that with.
It really is. I love how this show has grown over the months.
Mm-hmm.
We started with this little idea, and then it expanded over these past 12 episodes.
It's wild.
It was a big learning experience for us, kind of teaching ourselves how to run a podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And we went from acquaintances who hosted a show together to friends who host a show together.
Yes, that's the best part.
Gosh, we went through a lot this first season.
Oh yeah, we had to re-record almost an entire episode in the beginning.
I remember that.
I had the oldest MacBook. It was like 13 years old, and I have been editing on it for so many years, and it always crashed, and I was always upset about it. But for some reason, I was always like, it's only 13 years old. I could use it a little longer. And then it made this weird sound all the time. And so after that happened, I finally got a new laptop. It was the final push for me.
I wish we'd kept some of that audio because it sounds like, what is it? It sounds like the robot voice filter on iMovie.
Yeah.
That's what it would do to your audio. And it was,
yes.
It was
it
tragic
sounds like
to
a bad
to,
effect.
Yeah, it was tragic to have to edit around, but it was so funny.
It really was. I just felt so bad.
We would be sending each other voice notes of your raw audio. Like, do you know how this could have happened?
Oh, well. And that's all because we truly did not have any clue on how to podcast when going into this.
Nope.
We had no idea.
We just started with laptops, Adobe Audition, a microphone, and a dream.
Oh, I love that. And somehow along the way, people started to tune in and actually listen to this. Because in the beginning, there was the possibility of just no one tuning in. So thank you to everyone who turned
yes.
in. Imagine us coming on every 2 weeks and just talking about this and then no one would listen. It would still be fun. But it's more fun for people to actually enjoy this too.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun to share these stories with people.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it was just us on like a 2 hour FaceTime, which is
yes.
basically what this show is.
Yes. But I love how people listen to that and then they write messages about it and you just start another conversation about the same topic with someone else. I just
mm-hmm.
truly love that. I feel like we've created this space for people to just talk about these forgotten women, and I am so proud of us for this.
Proud of you too.
Oh, I want to hug you.
curse us being 6 hours
yes.
apart.
That is actually something I did not put in the questions, but just because we're on that topic, there were a couple of questions whether we've ever met in person, which just to clear that up, no. We simply know
not
each
yet.
Other from FaceTime.
Without modern technology, the show simply wouldn't have been
no.
possible.
But we really hope that we can meet next year.
Yes.
That's the goal.
My goal for 2025 and 26 is to start traveling, not be quite so much of a hermit. Our first question isn't so much of a question. It's just a significant thing that happened
mm-hmm.
in our classic rock sphere in the last couple weeks. Peter Sinfield, lyrical genius of King Crimson, has passed away at the age of 80. Emma, thoughts? I'll open the floor to you first.
A lot of heartbreak about it. Because I connect to their lyrics on such a deep level. I feel like it's a very poetic way of songwriting that I always admired. And it's just, I feel like whenever, we've talked about this, but whenever someone passes from that 60s and 70s time of period and music scene, it feels like it's fading away a little further. Mm-hmm. And it just like creates this big pain inside of me.
We're not ready to say goodbye.
No. Because it just brings the who's going to be next question with it that no one wants to think about, but it's kind of inevitable.
We got to start wrapping some of these guys in bubble wrap. Bob Dylan, Paul McCartney, Ringo Starr, wrap them in bubble wrap.
Should just freeze dry them.
Not cryogenically freezing Bob Dylan. Well,
what were your feelings?
I've said this and... you know, practically every prog episode I've made, it feels like that Islands is my favorite King Crimson album. It was partly because of these beautiful orchestral arrangements and partly because of having a literal actual poet write this record. The title track is sort of about the passage of time and the connection with nature that all of us humans have. As wacky and sparkly as prog rock can be, it's very human at the root of it. Think of In the Court of the Crimson King, right?
That's my favorite track.
It's the Fire Witch and the Crimson King and the...
It's such a great storytelling there.
Yes. And I thought of this passage from Islands that I have pulled up. Gaunt granite climbs where gulls wheel and glide. Mournfully glide o'er my island. My dawn bride's veil, damp and pale, dissolves in the sun. Love's web is spun, cats prowl, mice run. Wreath snatch hand briars where owls know my eyes. Violet skies, touch my island, touch me.
So beautiful.
The sun rises and sets over another icon of the day. Rest in violet skies, Peter Sinfield.
Couldn't have said it any better way.
Probably going to spin that record today.
Yeah.
All right. So our first honest-to-goodness question to lighten the mood, which is a question for Emma. How did you come up with the idea of making this podcast?
Okay. So there are two major inspirations behind this. The first one, I feel like, is kind of obvious. It's just the fact that when we talk about the 60s and 70s, we talk so much about the men. And I feel like generally there's nothing wrong with it because a lot of like the popular bands and actors and everything of the time were men. It was a very male-dominated time in a lot of ways. But then there were also so many incredible women, and I feel like their stories always kind of fell behind. There are so many women. For example, Patti Boyd. Everyone knew who she was in the 60s, but everyone only saw her as George Harrison's girlfriend and then later wife. And I feel like people really assumed that they had this picture-perfect relationship, and all the interviews that she gave, everything was so bubbly and happy. And it took people several years and decades after her biography had come out to realize what it was actually like for her and for her to be able to tell her truth. And I feel like it is so great that we get to witness these times where these women came out of the shadows and they're just kind of telling their truth, because it also puts the entire time into perspective and it shines a different light on everything. But I really wanted to have some sort of outlet to focus on the incredible women of the 1960s. And then the other big inspiration is a podcast called The Muse Podcast that does not run anymore, sadly. I got to talk to one of the podcast hosts. I don't know if I've told you this yet, Abby.
I don't know about this.
Because Shanti, she was like the one who started it several years ago, and they stopped to like just focus on some other projects for now. And she told us that she really loves what we're doing. So that felt so special because they kind of like had the same concept with their podcast.
Yeah, I'm bummed that show doesn't run anymore.
Me too. It was my go-to.
But they did important work before us, and hopefully we can carry the torch.
And then when I had that idea, I knew that I didn't want it to do it alone. So I was thinking who to join forces with, because First of all, I feel like it wouldn't be as interesting if it's only one person telling a story, because I feel like a big part of this show is us bringing our own perspectives and thoughts in. But then also just logistically, it's a lot of work to put together mm-hmm. an episode like this. And I feel like if it wouldn't have been split between the both of us, there would not be a way for me to do this on a bi-weekly basis. Mm-hmm. And so I only knew Abby from Instagram, basically. And like, we had talked a couple of times, but never seriously talked about anything. I bought clothes from you. I remember that, but that was several years ago. And so I kind of like, one day, it was April 1st. You reminded me of that. But one day I was just scrolling through Instagram and I saw, I don't even remember, I saw some post of you and I was like, I'm just going to reach out and see if she wants to do this with me.
Oh, what the hell?
And the rest is history.
I thought it was a joke. It was not a joke. You sent the whole project proposal at once in an email and I was so in.
I love that. I feel like we both were so dedicated with this from the beginning and we had so much fun doing it. It was really, I feel like this is a great match.
Yeah. You're like definitely the more palatable personality, I feel. I know I am brash and forward and blunt and you are much softer with things. You are generally better at handling the sensitive topics than me because I either get really fired up or I like shut down completely.
But I like that you're like that. I feel like it brings a different perspective and that just makes this show.
Yeah, I like this dynamic.
Me too. Our next question is, what is the research process like for each episode?
It's reading a lot of books and it's watching a lot of documentaries.
Yes.
And it's cross-referencing all of them to figure out what actually happened and what probably didn't happen.
Yeah.
There are some special cases where we were talking about this earlier, Emma. In the Edie Sedgwick episode, there is no officially sanctioned Edie mm-hmm. Sedgwick biography, so you had to do a lot of parsing out myth from reality.
Yeah. I decided to mainly go with the one written by a family member because I kind of felt mm-hmm. like this was a safer pathway. But I feel like with some of these figures like Edie Sedgwick, who are just such enigmatic figures, people will just write a biography going off of like a couple of things that they read and make up a lot of it along the way. And so I feel like that's always a big part that we try to fact check as much as possible. Also, generally, when someone wrote a biography, it makes our job a lot easier.
Mm-hmm.
The more there's out there about someone, it's just great. For example, the Uschi Obermeier episode, that was fairly easy to write because she wrote a biography. You can just kind of go off of that. But then on my end, the Jane Asher episode, there isn't a lot there, so you really have to dig a lot deeper.
Yeah, we were looking through like old news articles for that one.
Yes.
I remember like, what do I have in my archive that we could even post for a hint photo?
Mm-hmm.
The research process for the Cynthia Plastercaster episode was definitely very different. With episodes like these, you have to reach out to whatever contacts you can. The ones that replied were lovely. Everyone who replied was amazing and so helpful. I had to set up an interview without you because you were on vacation. You were like enjoying time off with your son and I was here interviewing Jeff.
Yes. I would have loved to do that too, but it was, I mean, you did the most fantastic job with
it. Thank you. You had questions you wanted to ask and you sent them my way. That was a more unorthodox research process, but I loved going on the chase.
Yes.
It was exciting.
It really was. And then just for like the process, one of us comes up with the script, then we like send it back and forth a couple of times just to kind of see if like someone has some notes, something that we want to change. Then we record it, someone edits it, we send it back and forth again, and then that's it. It seems so easy, but like some steps are a lot of work.
It's an involved process for sure.
Yes, but I love it.
Especially with scheduling with us 6 hours apart. Either I am awake early as fuck, or you are awake much past your bedtime.
I feel like we found a great time where it was like noon for me and not too early in the morning for you, but that doesn't always work. Mm-hmm. So right now it's like 8:30, but for me, which is fine. I'm a little tired, but it's okay. I'm also, I feel like I'm old because it's only 8:30, but I've been up since 5, so what do I know?
You've been up since before the sun was. You're fine. We have an episode-specific question next, a couple of them.
Yes. The first one is, why didn't you talk about Nico's hate towards black people?
I assume this question is asking about the time Nico assaulted a black woman.
Yes, I think so too. So, just to preface this, we talked about this. You and I talked about this. It just didn't make the episode.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was one of these things that we said earlier where it's a lot of he said, she said. No one really actually knows what's happening and what happened. And there's also, obviously, this is wrong. It is wrong to assault someone. Racism is wrong. But you have to understand the time that she came from, the environment in which she grew up. But we felt like it was a topic really difficult to explain and very time-consuming to go into.
We had some trouble parsing out the context of her little comment about Jews, which is like my number one bone to pick with Nico.
Yeah, of course, anti-Semitism, racism, it's wrong. There is no excuse for that. We all know that. We don't want to excuse her for doing that. It was obviously wrong and horrible of her to do that.
On that vein, in the Grace Slick episode, what are your thoughts on the shrimp salad incident? I presume this listener is talking about this stage rant that Grace went on in, I believe, May of 1970. She talks about shrimp. She makes some weird comments about white people and black people. When you talk about Grace Slick, you have to pick and choose which drunken rants you feature. I talked about this one she went on at a dinner party, and the one I really wanted to focus on, the dialogue that I wanted to open up, was who won the war. That's obvious. That's the one you think of when you think of Grace Slick going off on stage. And who won the war made the cut.
Yes. I feel like generally speaking, we kind of have to pick and choose what we want to talk about with these women, because otherwise episodes would be 8 hours long. For some people, there's just so much to talk about. And so sometimes things don't make the cut. But obviously, it was an insane incident.
The shrimp rant was a little weird. The two main Grace incidents I chose to feature were the blackface on television and who won the war. Two doozies right in a row. If you could change something about the episodes you've done so far, what would it be?
I have a major thing here. So as said, we kind of like made this podcast up as we went. And one thing that I really like about our newer episode is the fact that we started to incorporate music and interview snippets. And I feel like this is something, looking back, we could have and maybe should have done from episode one. But it was kind of like an idea that came to us along the way.
I had music, a little bit of music, in Grace Slick's episode.
Yeah.
I really wanted music in the Nico episode.
We were also a little insecure about what you can get away with, because we don't own this music, and we're both coming from YouTube, a platform that is very restrictive on using someone's music. We just thought there was an opportunity of us adding like 10 seconds of a Nico Velvet Underground song and the entire episode being blocked.
Yeah, it's happened to me.
Yes, it happened to me too. So we kind of like went the safe route at the beginning, but now that we know that we can do that, we'll definitely do it more going forward. Yes.
I also have one big correction to make from the Cynthia Plastercaster episode, because I messed up. I accidentally cut off Babette Novak's last name. That's the one big thing I would change about that episode, Babette Novak. I'm so sorry.
I think she'll forgive you.
Oof, we all make mistakes.
The next question is, if you could meet any of the women, who would it be?
Cynthia. It's not hard for me.
She's interesting. Yeah, I'd agree. But also, after reading that biography, Uschi Obermeier has really intrigued me. I feel like she has so many great stories to tell. Obviously, someone like Edie, who I feel like is very misunderstood, would be interesting to meet and just to kind of get your own perspective.
Yeah, maybe just hear her out, let her talk for a while, just to get it all out there.
But I feel like generally we wouldn't choose these women if we wouldn't love to spend some time with them.
Yes.
So this kind of goes for everyone.
Yes, like Nico is fascinating, but I would not break bread with her personally.
It would for sure be interesting to sit down with her and like see what she has to say, but there would probably be a lot of things that we wouldn't agree with.
Yes. What is a doll you wished could be in season one? I feel like our answer is going to be the same. So just 3, 2, 1, Anita Pallenberg.
I knew this was going to happen. So Anita will most likely be part of season two. She's just a complicated figure in the sense that she hasn't written her own biography. There are a couple out there. I always recommend Parachute Women because it just has, I feel like, a lot of perspective. But then I also feel like Keith Richards' biography gives you a great insight on who she was. But she's just hard to research and hard to get, even, in a sense.
She's hard to get a read on.
Yes. And so for me personally, when we started this podcast, I wanted to start out with someone who felt easier to cover, to kind of like test the waters a little. And now I feel a lot more confident going into someone like Anita Pallenberg. Mm-hmm. Because I feel like she's very misunderstood and I have a lot of love and appreciation for her. So I feel like she'll definitely be a subject on this podcast.
Yes, we saw it in the Chris O'Dell episode. Anita's personality was not for everyone.
People either loved her passionately or really didn't get along with her.
Mm-hmm.
What was your favorite episode?
Oh gosh, I have my favorite. I don't know why it took me so long to think of this. My favorite that I didn't write, Karen Carpenter's episode.
I feel like this is my favorite one that I wrote too. Because this for sure wasn't the most fun to record. I feel like we did a great job telling her story. I feel like it's a well-rounded episode of who she was. I at least hope so.
You were the right person to tell it.
Thank you. That means a lot. I can't choose for you. I have two.
All right.
My top two. I mean, obviously the Cynthia episode had to be up there. It's just, it's one of these persons where you just managed to uncover so much that no one knew before, and that just stunned me. I love that. And then a personal favorite of mine was the Maraike episode.
Maraike was,
I love her.
Loads of fun to write about because she was just such a free spirit. She went wherever the wind took her.
Yeah. But now that we're thinking about it, the Ronnie episode was great.
That was my favorite that I wrote. That's a really important story to tell because not all abusers are going to be as maniacal as Phil Spector was.
No, he was top notch.
But I wanted to outline exactly how abusers get their hooks into their victims, right?
I feel like you did a great job doing that.
Ronnie Spector wasn't a victim, though. She was a survivor.
Yes, for sure.
And I wanted to portray her as a survivor. I wanted to highlight those little things that men like Phil Spector do to dismantle even the strongest of women.
Yeah.
Is there someone you'd love to make an episode about, but they're too hard to research?
Absolutely, yes. Someone I came across rather recently is a woman called Dot Roan. And when I found out about her, I frantically texted Abby, and we both had no idea about her. So she was Paul McCartney's first girlfriend, way long before he was dating Jane Asher. And I only found out about her from reading Cynthia Lennon's biography, because she talks about her briefly, but there really isn't a lot, or maybe nothing known about her beside the fact that she was with Paul. And also, this is the craziest part, she was, I want to say, 15. He was 17 when she got pregnant. And her mother suggested that she just go to the city, have the kid, give it up for adoption and come back. But Paul actually said he wanted to marry her and just have a family. And so his dad even set up a courthouse wedding for the two of them, but then she sadly lost a child, and they ended up breaking up a little later. But I was stunned when I read about her, because I feel like I've read so much about the Beatles in my time, my life, and I have not once heard about her before.
That would be fascinating.
Maybe one day we'll find, like, a little speck.
Even just somebody who knew her.
Yeah. Even someone who knows whether she's still alive. Because, I mean, she could be still alive. I didn't think about that. She must be, like, 80-something right now. She could very well still be alive.
I have a couple women I would like to write an episode about, but they would be very difficult to research. My first would be Miss Christine of the GTOs. Just people know her from the album covers she was on and for being the Zappa's nanny, but all we really know about her is, you know, a few things that her family have said. They run social media accounts for her, and you know, what we know about her from Pamela's book and Mercy's book and being in the GTOs.
Yeah.
I mean, she was 22 when she passed. 22 or 23.
Super young.
So it's not even, again, not even like a Miss Pamela situation where she thought to keep a diary about this life that she was living in Laurel Canyon in the 60s. But her family does have a lot of her personal affects. They saved her record collection, her magazine collection, all of her sewing supplies, the clothes she made. I don't know. I would like to see some GTO's things in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Museum.
Yes.
They better get on that.
They really
Because they
should.
Do exist. They do exist.
Mm-hmm. Well kept.
And another woman I would like to write an episode on, but she's so shrouded in myth, is Licorice McKechnie of the Incredible String Band.
Yes.
She went missing one day. She went for a hike and never came back.
It's a wild story.
This is surrounding, like, the ISB getting into Scientology and stuff. So, a lot of mystery surrounding that.
We could do, like, a true crime take on this.
Oh, God. I don't think I want to be a true crime podcaster.
It freaks me out. I get scared so easily by these things. Do you think you'll have guest stars in the future? And this kind of ties in with the question of, have you ever tried or thought inviting an actual doll to talk about her life on the podcast?
Listen, we've gotten guest stars in season one.
Yes.
I feel like we could do it again.
Yeah.
It's all about, like, sending the bat signal up, basically, and just whoever replies to you, and whoever doesn't, doesn't. I feel like I can speak for you on this, because we've already brought her up like three times on this episode alone.
Oh, yeah.
We would love to.
That would be great. Also, Patty Boyd. I mean, the chances are slim, but I'm just saying, if you're listening to this and you want to come out.
Yeah. We're really shooting for the moon with Patty, but
we always have a place for you if you ever want to come on here. But yeah. I feel like with these really big personalities, it isn't likely. Although I feel like Miss Pamela, we have a connection to her. We have a mutual friend, basically. And then also, she's very open in, like, being a guest on things. There were two women I actually thought about reaching out, but didn't have the balls to. It was Jane Asher and Uschi Obermeier. So with Jane, I didn't want to reach out in the end, because during her career, she always said she doesn't want to talk about her time with the Beatles. She just want to talk about herself and, like, her career. And I really respect that. But I didn't know if she liked the angle that we had with the episode, because we talked a lot about her time with the Beatles. And then with Uschi, I don't know. I got scared.
A lesson to be learned with making content like we do is just, like, reach out while they're still alive, man.
Yes. We really should. I was just thinking, everyone who is still alive, we could just always reach out, because there's nothing that could happen to us besides just getting turned away.
Yeah, I actually reached out to Marika. I forgot I did that.
I remember that.
I sent a couple emails. I didn't get a reply, but Marika is a very private person. She's just, like, on her horse ranch with her horses, doing her paintings.
Which is beautiful. Yeah.
She's, like, in her 80s now, She's fine. This is a fashion question. We got some clothes questions in here. Need to know where you ladies get your clothes from. And I wish the answer was that easy.
Yes. And I wish the answer was, go to this website and order this. Because I feel like a lot of the times people want to get a piece of clothing that you have. And it is really dissatisfying because chances of finding something is slim. Because I feel like I can speak for the both of us when I say we mostly have vintage pieces from actually the 60s and 70s. So tracking these down is really hard. And a lot of them, at least for me, are kind of like treasure finds. Like, I don't always go out searching for that one thing. I'll just come across it.
Like, I have when I shop, I have vague ideas of what I might like in mind. And I just kind of hold on to them and hope I find them. If I want something really, really specific, then Depop is... I am a Depop girly, unfortunately.
I would love to be one, but they don't ship overseas.
You guys have Vinted, right?
Yes. I mean, it's basically the same. I know that a lot of people, and this might be a controversial take, I know that a lot of people go to these like specific 1960s vintage boutiques on Etsy. And I think it's great. If you want to do that, if you want to spend like $300 on a dress, then that is fine. But I can just tell you...
I've done it before.
Yes, but I can just tell you from my perspective, it has happened to me and it has happened to a couple of my friends. When I do like a story sale, I try to price things reasonably. So I try to be like, okay, this does have a stain. It couldn't be that expensive. And it happened to me, it happened to a couple of friends that people will buy something. And then 2 weeks later, I open Etsy and I see the exact same piece. It's my piece. Someone bought it from me for $10 and they sell it for $250. And it makes me mad. It just doesn't sit right with me, if I'm being honest. Because then I feel like if I would have known, I would have sold it to someone who would just wear it for themselves. Because I don't like the whole idea of reselling, because it just really ups the price for everyone.
Yeah, I saw a dress I wanted circulate around like that. I definitely noticed that. But then I just went and made it myself, so.
That's always great, too.
Yeah, I guess that's the other thing. I make a good amount of things that I wear and post, because I know how to do that. I think
that's great.
Learning even basic sewing skills is so important if you would like to dress in a vintage style, because then you can buy the $5, $10 things that just need a couple quick fixes, and you can do them yourself and get so much wear out of it. I had a shirt I wore until it broke, and then I fixed it, and I'm just going to keep wearing it. My young Edwardian dress, I've had to fix like 5 different things on it. There's this dress I found for $2, and the zipper I put in cost more than the dress.
Yeah, I feel like also generally knowing how to do like the basics of tailoring is great, because with vintage pieces, you will most likely not find the piece in like your exact size. It is rare. So just know how to like take in a seam, let out a seam, just helps you tremendously, because it just makes the clothing available to you so much broader. But do you have like any favorite 60s and 70s inspired brands? Maybe this is easier for people to buy from.
The Hippie Shake's on break right now.
They are.
And I'm bummed.
I have great pieces.
I had a few pieces from them that I've snapped up on Depop and Poshmark from their past seasons. That's mostly how I buy the Hippie Shake. Because that's out of my price range, out of my tax bracket, you know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I get it. If pieces are just handmade, high quality, I totally get it. But I also feel it is great to buy them secondhand. It's always good to save something. I really like the chain design, too. And the Belated Beatnik. These are like two brands that I really adore.
Didn't the Belated Beatnik make your wedding dress?
Yes. She's a friend of mine, Coco. She's so great. Because I basically reached out to her and I was like, I need that Sharon Tate wedding dress. And you could auction that at one point at Julian's for, I think, $30,000. And that was a little outside of my price range. You know, just a little bit. But she... The good thing about Julian's auctions, just a little shout out here, they upload the most high quality detailed pictures of their pieces ever. And you can always take a look back. And so we had like 20 pictures, every seam, every detail of the dress. And she was able to basically replicate the entire thing.
I know that from my art history days. Auction house photography is the best. And some museums, not all.
Yes.
I'm still a little mad at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Museum for not taking a picture of Rob Tyner's shiny disco pirate shirt. I've been trying to make that shirt for years.
That would be a great one.
But when Patty Boyd's, bless you, when Patty Boyd's Christie's auction, I think it was Christie's,
yes.
All of us vintage reproduction girlies were losing our marbles because we finally knew how her fool dress was cut.
Yes.
From like the two photos we had.
Yes. It was great. And you also know for sure the colors because mm-hmm. a lot of the times when you find old pictures, they might be recolored by someone who mm-hmm. did their best and it's a beautiful picture, but they don't know all the colors correctly. Mm. So I feel like it's always great if you just get a high resolution shot of something.
Yes.
It's rare, but it's wonderful.
All right. Mm-hmm. Any tips on finding cheap, funky tights? You have a lot better luck with this than I do.
I get all of my tights basically from the thrift store. And a lot of the times, the elastic is whacked. And like usually I don't know what it is about tights, but usually the body, like the actual leg part, holds up great. But mm-hmm. like the one piece that goes around your stomach just does not have any stretch anymore. So here's my number one tip. You all need to get a pair of bike shorts or like some sort of like really short, really tight gymnastic shorts because mm-hmm. I wear those. And then even if I'm like almost losing the tight, it doesn't matter because I have the shorts over it. So on the leg, it'll all look fine. Mm-hmm. And I, with like my short dresses, I always wear shorts underneath anyways. Mm-hmm. So this is a win-win.
Yeah, I'm so jealous of people who just find tights at thrift stores. We don't have those here.
Really? At every random thrift store, there's like a big bin of like
I always nylons. Look in the bins and I never find anything good.
I'm going to keep my eyes out for you.
It's like the one thing that I ever get off Amazon and then I wear them until they break. Mm. So I absolutely get the use out of the fast fashion. Tabby socks are great as well. My number one issue with the tights is like they're suddenly baggy around the ankles and legs.
Yeah, they lose their stretch over the years.
Mm.
Your all-time favorite iconic dress.
We already answered this.
Yes.
But there's mine is the Patty Boyd fool dress. Yes. All the way.
And mine is definitely Sharon Tate's wedding dress and the Paco Rabanne dress that Francois Hardy wore, the metal one. I've looked into making this so many times. Supplies are crazily expensive. You could do it. I don't think it's that hard. But it's like
Mars Maddox made hers.
Yes. I talked to her and she like sent me everything where she got it. I was like, I need to know. But she also said like, I feel like making it cost her several hundred bucks just in supplies mm-hmm. and like hours mm-hmm. and hours on end. But I feel like she's a musician. So this is a great stage outfit. For me, on the other hand, where am I going to wear something like this? Yeah. Do I ever have an occasion to wear this? But maybe. I feel like one day I'll make that dress.
If just for a fun project, you know? What are your current favorite songs?
So my favorite song whenever fall and winter comes around is Girl from North Country. It's just something about it is so perfect as soon as it gets cold.
Which version?
The Bob Dylan, Johnny Cash version for sure.
Mm. If you're traveling in the North Country Fair, where the winds hit heavy on the borderline, please say hello to one who lives there. Mine right now, I have some... It's the nature of the job. I have a lot of music swirling around in my head at any given moment. I'm going to see Slow Dive tomorrow. Round two of Slow Dive. And I've really been latching on to the Just for a Day album mm-hmm. recently. It was their first honest to goodness album. Brighter is so... It's so un-Slow Dive, mm-hmm. and I think that's why I dig it so much. I I've also been clinging onto Nick Drake recently. I always do. Nick is just so great for the transitional seasons mm-hmm. of both nature and life.
Yeah.
I'm working on the Five Leaves Later special right now.
That's also a great one.
With where, well, spoiler alert, I'll be featuring both Five Leaves Left and Brighter Later. And Hazy Jane 1 off Brighter Later. I love that one.
Yes.
What's that lyric? Do you find things are moving just a little too fast? Yes, I do, Nick. I always do.
Do you feel like a remnant of something that's past? Do you find things are moving just a little too fast? Do you hope to find new ways of quenching your thirst? Do you hope to find new ways of doing better than your worst? Hey, slow Jane, let me prove. Slow, slow Jane, we're on the move.
I've also been listening a lot to the late Beatles lately. I don't know, something about that final Beatles album. Just, I feel like as soon as it's fall, I like the sad, slow, deep music. And something about that last Beatles album is so melancholic to me. I know that when they recorded it, they didn't know that this was going to be the last album, because they recorded the last two released albums in different order.
Mm-hmm.
But something about their final record is just, it always makes me feel like there was a feeling that this was going to be the last one.
Yeah, the Get Back and Let It Be period was so precarious.
Yes.
You know, they'd just come off the back of White Album sessions, which were awful.
Everyone hated each other a little.
Lars Land had to back out of making their White Album special because it just really got to them. Just like reading, you know, Paul McCartney. This session was Paul McCartney solo. John wasn't here this day. George wasn't here this day. Ringo left this day. Which makes me a little worried about covering the White Album myself. It's my favorite Beatles record, but it's a doozy.
I feel like, obviously, music is so close to the people who make it. And I feel like with the Beatles, I once listened to all Beatles records from, like, the first one, and I have, like, a pressing of the Beatles' My Bonnie Is Over the Ocean and, like, all the Hamburg pressings, and then, like, up until Abbey Road. And I feel like you can hear them falling apart if you just go through it. At the beginning, it's so upbeat and so fun, and then I feel like it's also them maturing, obviously, but it's also, I don't know, you can hear them drifting apart.
George had been playing with these guys since he was a teenager, and he's like an adult man now who wants to do his own thing. And all of the Beatles were kids together, and then they were adults and had to figure out, okay, what do I want to do as an adult? Where do I fit into this?
Yes, and I also feel like they went through the most craziest thing one could imagine.
Yep.
I feel like the strain and the energy it must take to, like, survive Beatlemania for them must have been insane. And I feel like, as sad as it is, it's not surprising that the relationships and all of that didn't last through that madness. It was just so much, and they were so young. What books or documentaries about the 60s and 70s do you both enjoy?
My shelves back here, I know you have both of these books. I have a copy of Wonderful Tonight, and I have a copy of I'm with the Band Always.
I can really recommend a book that we will most likely never cover in this, because it was written by a man, but Keith Richard, Life. It's a fantastic autobiography. It really is one of the best autobiographies I've ever read.
Yeah, it's actually been of use to us a few times in episodes.
Because he goes so into depth about so many things, and he's so blunt about things, which I really like.
Pretty matter of fact.
Yeah. And then also Parachute Women. It's just a great collection of stories.
we were talking about Richard Morton Jack's Nick Drake book earlier. Those are the ones we'll never feature.
Yeah. Maybe one day we'll do like a man special.
That would have to be Jim Morrison, though.
Oh, yeah. He Eric Clapton. They kind of like have to. Yeah. They really earned their spots.
We can't get rid of those two. What are some of your favorite rock and roll couples?
Oh, where do I even begin with this? I don't know if they qualify as a rock and roll couple, but Jane Birkin and Serge Gainsbourg.
They absolutely count.
They do, right? They are not rock and roll people, if you want to say so. Like, their music is just not that category. But I feel like by the way that they live their life, they really qualify for this category. And I feel like there is a lot of footage about them out there. There's just a lot about them in general out there. They were really public. But they just seem to have such genuine love for each other. And I really adore that.
Gosh, how do I top that? You don't. You know, I think about George and Patty often because, again, the crazy outside circumstances of being a Beatle in the 60s and Eric Clapton entering the chat.
Yes.
And all of these Hare Krishnas are suddenly living in our house.
Yeah.
And they just got married so young.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't like fully formed people yet.
Mm-mm.
But I love that they were able to maintain a friendship even after they found they just could not work as husband and wife.
I feel like they matured together and came to this decision. And it's fine because they really had nothing but love for each other.
Mm.
And then my favorite underrated rock and roll couple is Ringo and Maureen. They had the most wholesome yet most messy relationship ever.
They were so messy.
Yes. But I mean, it's kind of the same for them. They remained friends after they broke up. They also had like a bunch of kids together. So you kind of like have to keep it on good terms. But yeah, I feel like Maureen, she wasn't as public as the other Beatles girls in a lot of senses. But yeah, I don't know. Something about them just always seemed so nice.
Bob and Sarah Dillon are quite intriguing as well.
Yes. Even though Bob always told everyone he wasn't married, they're still a nice couple.
I kind of wish Sarah Dillon got to tell her side of the story, but she never will.
I don't think so either. No,
she's just not that kind of person. She was just like a normal woman who happened to be married to Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
And that's what makes her so intriguing.
Kind of like Cynthia Lennon. These two would probably get along quite well. What is your favorite song by the Beatles?
It's almost too on brand. While My Guitar Gently Weeps. I don't think people need an explanation for why.
Yeah. No, it's a fantastic song. I look at you all, see the love. I feel like the one that had the most emotional value to me is Here, There, and Everywhere because it was my wedding song.
Aww.
So that's now like a little extra special. And I also really like it. It's a great song. But yeah, I mean, how do you choose? They obviously have an abundance of incredible songs. To lead a better life, I need my love. What got you both into 60s and 70s music, art, and fashion?
Mine was sort of a lot of circumstances piling onto each other that basically happened because I went to art school and I wanted to be cool, so I started collecting vinyl.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, so that sort of led me into the path of, you know, coming into ownership of Rolling Stones albums and then Beatles albums and wondering, hey, this music is cool. What do these guys dress like in their everyday lives? Oh, this is really cool. Granny Takes a Trip was awesome. What did these guys' wives and girlfriends look like? And then it was all over.
Yeah. I feel like there's a point where there's no turning back.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, mainly was music. My dad raised me on Bob Dylan and Johnny Cash. And as a kid, I did not understand that. I was like, this is not music. This is sounds. What is it? Turn on ABBA or something. But the older I get, the more I just really get it. And then I feel like the two major things for me were the Beatles and just like their music really resonated with me. I'm the kind of person, when I like something, I want to know everything about it. And so I really fell into that rabbit hole. And the other segue into it were movies. I've always been like very interested in films, and especially the French New Wave cinema of the 1960s really got me started on like a lot of the time and like a lot of the people. And then I had a big love for Roman Polanski, not as a person, but like as a director and all his art. I just really like his films. I think he's a great director, not a good person. But yeah, then I learned about Sharon Tate, and that was kind of it. The rest is just whatever this has come to.
We have some host-specific questions next.
Yes, I'm just going to start and ask you the first one. Abby, what do you think that your Fantano critic video will probably become your most viewed one?
I was holding out for one of my episodes to hit 100,000 views, and well, it was this one-off video that I made. Something finally surpassed Blind Faith, though, which I'm pretty happy about. How do I feel about it? It's like planning a really great funeral. You know, you're really happy that this thing, that you pulled off this thing, but I'm still not happy. You're not happy to go to a funeral. I wasn't happy.
No.
To form a critique of somebody I really admire and who is the reason my career path exists. Like, I posted it on election night so that it would go to like a really small group of people and would like open up the conversation about snark first criticism in like the Vinyl Monday bubble, but it very, very quickly breached containment. And I was like, well, can't delete the video now, can't undo this. I opened up the conversation and here we are.
Just gotta roll with it. Did you anticipate it?
No. I honestly thought this was gonna get 2,000 views, 4,000 views and be forgotten. And that's clearly not what happened.
It's the same for me. My first video to like hit 500,000 views or something, and I think the only one to ever get that high up, is the one about baby groupies. It is a touchy subject, and there are a lot of like, even now, and it's been like 3 years since I've made this video, every day I get notifications from people commenting under that video. It just does not go away ever again. Yep.
I still get comments on the Blind Faith video, even though it's like a C-tier Vinyl Monday episode at this point. But
it's a great one.
Can't beat the thumbnail. That's the thing. You can't beat the thumbnail. If you Google the Blind Faith album art, I come up.
That's sweet.
And it's, ugh. you can't take it back now. So that's how I feel about this Fantano debacle. It happened. I'm moving on. So, Emma, this question says, Emma, you mentioned starting out studying biology. What did you originally plan to do in that field, and what made you change directions?
Okay, I have to clear this up. I never studied biology. I feel like this is a misunderstanding because the school system here works different than it does in the US. So basically, when you want to graduate with the highest academic degree that you can then go on to go to university, you have to do several subjects on a specific level to surpass them. It's like German, it's math, you have to do one foreign language, and then you have to do something that is like art or history related, and something that is science. And I am not good at any science or math thing. It's not for me. I admire people who can do it, I can't. But I had to choose one of them, and I went with biology. And I enjoyed it, but I would have never imagined going into that direction. I feel like the confusion comes from me once telling about this, like, assignment that I made for getting my, like, it's kind of like a high school diploma, basically, where I basically researched how what you're watching on TV will influence you because of, like, the neurons in your brain. And this sometimes comes into play when we talk about the 60s and 70s, and it just kind of, like, breaches into different things. But no, I never did that. I actually always wanted to go into film, and that's what I did. I always wanted to write and direct, which I did for a little.
We love a queen who knows exactly what she wants to do and knows exactly how to get it.
I was very set on that, but I ended up becoming a prop master, which I also really liked. The one thing that I did not like about that job, though, was that I would work minimum 55 hours a week, mostly more like 75 or something. It was hefty. The days were long. I was always gone. I didn't have an apartment for 2 years, and it never, like, I didn't have an apartment, not because of money reasons, but just of the sheer reason that I was always going from one production to the other, and I was never home anyway. So at one point I was just like, when my lease is up, I'm just gonna move out, and that's it. And I feel like it was great. I loved that career, but deep down I knew that this was not going to be it forever. And I'm actually at a point in my life where I'm considering going back to, or not even back to, going to university to get a degree. So I'm gonna see where it'll take me. I'll let you know.
Yeah. Exciting new things.
Yes. There's another question for Abby. What was your original goal as an art major, and why did you move toward art history and criticism?
Right. So I originally, you know, I did love to draw and I did love to paint, and I put up one exhibition and did fine. Art history was the natural direction to go to in college because I wanted to go into conservation. I did really, really well in science. I was actually a STEM kid.
I admire that greatly.
Because for art conservation, you basically need a chemistry background with some art skills, and that happened to be my skill set. So I went into school thinking that's what I was going to do, and then I started writing papers, going on doing these research projects, and that clicked with an area of my brain. I'm just a natural seeker. And I loved to write my whole life. And then I just sort of became a writer through that. I got out of school. It was a weird time post-pandemic. You know, getting a job in the field just wasn't working. I basically started Vinyl Monday to kill some time, and now look what it's done. It became a job.
That's great, though. It's always good to find something you love.
I really consider myself a writer first and a presenter on YouTube second, which kind of leads into the next question. What are your professional long-term goals? If it is writing within the music industry, how difficult is it to work for a major rock media organization such as Rolling Stone these days? What are my professional long-term goals? I don't really know where I'm headed with this.
I feel like this is very common within the people who do, like, YouTube or social media in general. Everyone's kind of like, I don't know where I'm going with it. No one does.
Yeah.
Because I feel like this is hard to understand for people who aren't doing this. You never know if it'll last. You don't even know if it'll last tomorrow. It could happen that we put out the next YouTube video and for some reason no one watches it. And then what?
That's why I started seriously writing again and kind of getting my website back up and running so that I'm not just a person on YouTube. I am a music critic and I have something to show for it. Because, you know, people over 50, they know what YouTube is, but they don't know that you, like, have to write a whole video.
Yeah.
You don't just sit down in front of the camera and waffle. I mean, You could, but that won't take you very far.
I was just gonna say, if you are able to waffle a video in the quality that you do, you're like some sort of superhuman. There is no way. No one can actually like have all of these dates, all of these things in their mind. There's just no way.
Would I want to write for a major music publication? I mean, the only really space for me out there is like the weekly classic album reviews on Pitchfork. That's really all that's out there. I'm just kind of carving my own path with this.
You could start your own magazine.
If it leads to something, hell, why not? One of my big goals is to be writing liner notes.
That would be great.
I would like to write liner notes for special releases. I think it could be done. I've wanted to since Funhouse, that whole... what Henry Rollins wrote for that, for its 50th anniversary. Just Henry Rollins, one of my all-time favorite music writers.
He's great.
Also happens to be in Black Flag, no big deal. But like, yeah, Lester Bangs, David Frick, Henry Rollins, Jess Hopper. I don't know. I'm just shooting for the moon, and the long-term professional goal is wherever that takes me.
You're going places, I'm sure.
I hope so. Anthony Fantano of Classic Rock?
On your YouTube channels, is there someone else behind the camera, or can you produce the presentation on your own?
We both do all of this ourselves.
You're my only colleague in any sort of way.
Oh.
I mean, you're my friend first, but like, you're the only person I work with creatively.
Mm.
I feel like people always think that like YouTube videos are such a professional thing, which to some extent they are. I feel like both you and me, we put a lot of work into like researching things, but like the filming isn't as big as people would imagine, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, writing, filming, editing, putting the stuff out there, all done by one person. Would I love to hire a couple video editors? Absolutely. Am I in the place to do that? Not yet.
I also don't want to do it because I don't want to lose, like, the creative hand on it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel like you shape your video. I mean, obviously, the writing process is big, but I feel like you also shape it so much through the editing. But yeah, I feel like we both aren't the kind of person to have big production crews here or like big photo shoots. It's always us.
I don't have the space for it, man. I don't think people realize how small the space I film in is. I cramp myself and all of my equipment in like a 3x5 foot space. And that's not easy for me to do. It's like my knees are practically up to my shoulders.
You always see like one corner of the room and you just assume everything is perfect. But I filmed a like thing here with a bunch of outfits. And let me tell you, everything besides the bit that you're seeing right now is wrecked. This room is stuffed. There's things flying everywhere. It's fine.
Oh, yeah. Like album jackets on every flat surface. And, like, places that shouldn't be light stands become light stands. It'll be much better when I move into a bigger, better space. I've gotten to the point where I've outgrown this space now, and the wheels are starting to turn.
That's important.
If for nothing but to accommodate the collection. I have to say, it is great to have friends who do what you do, to know other YouTube people. Because we can complain to each other about, like, this is a bitch to edit, and the YouTube copyright system is on my ass today. Lars Land and Nancy of Vinyl Friday, we all do music stuff, so one of us will be like, the YouTube copyright system is being so mean to me today, or, like, filming is no joke, you know? Yeah. It's great to have those people.
It is.
Because this is the weirdest job in the world.
It really is. And you never know where it's going to take you.
Now, last question.
Wow, this was quick.
Are you doing a season 2?
I am so happy to announce we are.
Yes.
We're gonna be back, and it'll not be too long because we will be back in January. Abby, when exactly will we be back?
We will be back on Friday, January 10th for the season 2 premiere of the Dolls podcast.
Yes.
We're taking the rest of November and December off because that's a very busy time for what we do outside of the show.
It truly is.
You have your Vlogmas series I have double album December. I can't wait for what you have in store for Vlogmas. I think it's such a unique idea.
I was about to say the same thing. Oh, thank you.
And double album December, if I can pull this off, if I can pull these next 4 weeks off, it will be the god run of my YouTube channel.
I'm rooting for you. I feel like you'll make it.
Will there be another intermission sequence with the intermission corkboard? Who knows?
I'm looking forward to it.
Thanks for tuning in to the first season of Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s. We hope you enjoyed our journey through these 12 episodes of amazing women of the 60s and 70s.
As always, we are your hosts, Emma
and Abby.
And we're thrilled to have you with us on this groovy adventure. Remember, the spirit of these trailblazing ladies lives on in each one of us, inspiring us to embrace our individuality, creativity, and passion for change.
If you like what you heard, don't forget to subscribe to, rate, and review the show on your favorite streaming platform. Your feedback means the world to us, as does your audience participation for this episode, and it helps others discover the magic of these legendary dolls.
As always, we'd like to thank special friend of the show, Michael Teggio, for the wonderful intro song. We hope you have a great start to the next year. Until then, keep the music loud, the fashion groovy, and the spirit of the 60s and 70s alive in your hearts.
Peace,
love,
and rock and roll.